done fell right down that rabbit hole. So reality is questionable. Try, but you just can't let it go. These two right here put on a show. It's paranormal overload with Southern hospitality. Haunted murder mayhem tip while discussing immortality. Locations with a dark past, history that comes to life. Hillbillies with a knack for everything that goes bump at night. Overthinking if you're by yourself, these two will have you turning on the lights. Mixing in a little comedy to make sure it all fits in just right. Hey.
Welcome to Hillbilly Horror Stories. Now here's your hosts, Jerry and Tracy Hall, and their dog Ninja.
Sometimes their cat, Freddy, but never the ferrets.
Hi, this is Dave Schrader from the Ghosts of Devil's Perch on Travel Channel and Discovery Plus, and you're listening to Hillbilly Horror Stories.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 395 of Hillbilly Horror Stories. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Tracy.
As usual, we want to thank all of our military and civil servants all over the world, no matter which country you represent. Thanks for all you men, women, and service animals for everything you do for us on a daily basis.
You guys are our rock, and we pray for you all every single day. Thank you for keeping our country safe. We love you.
Tracy, unfortunately, it was another week of tragedies and stuff. We had some tornadoes hit.
We did.
Across Indiana, Ohio, and some other states. Some deaths involved in those, unfortunately. So our thoughts are with all those families that were affected one way, shape, or form. It just goes to show how many things happen in the world every day that affects our mental psyche.
No, you're right. Exactly. And I mean, it's a scary thing anyway, but, you know, and not only that, you have to deal with the aftermath, you know, so that kind of affects you as well.
So it's a good lead in to if you guys are in a situation where you need to talk to somebody, whether it be us, whether it be the group, whether it be professionally, friends, family members, whoever, talk to somebody. That's all I'm going to say on it this week. Just talk to somebody. There's no shame in it.
Amen.
All right, Tracy. Wow. I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say that the story we're going to cover tonight is the best story that we've ever done.
I think you've said that a couple times.
Yeah, this one's the best. and I can tell you this for a fact, it's the longest we've ever done.
Okay.
So I keep track by how many pages of notes that I do. And I've had a couple, the really long ones, that got to like 34, 35 pages. This was 48 pages of notes.
Oh my gosh.
So.
Good grief.
Yeah, it's going to be a while. Settle in. If ever we were going to do a two-parter, this would have been it, but I decided not to make it two parts. Because really, as you're going to hear, there's really no way to break it up.
Okay.
Like, you know, we did the Amityville story, and we broke it up into, you know, the Ronald DeFeo part, mm-hmm. and then the Lutz's part. That's a good, clean break. You got two stories within one.
Yeah.
This one's really not like that.
We'll keep on trucking.
And then stick with us after we get finished with the story, because we got some announcements
tonight. Okay.
All right, Tracy. Wow. I think this is the most fascinating haunting that I have ever researched. And I've always said the Bell Witch has always been my favorite episode.
Mm-hmm.
As far as just the hauntings that go along with it and all the stories. But I think this one tops it. This is also a haunting that Ed and Lorraine Warren were involved with. And we've seen some blockbuster type movies come from the Warren cases, such as the Conjuring movies and the Amityville Horror, previously spoken about. This story, though, was kept secret for many years until Jessica Moffat wrote a book detailing all the events that happened during this time. Like I said, the book came out in 2015. It was called Unwelcomed: The True Story of the Moffat Family Haunting. And this was largely based on her mother's stories. So we'll get into it. I'll try to cut down any confusion. But Jessica was a granddaughter in this. She was very young at the time. So she probably don't really remember a whole lot. But we're going to hear from Jessica in the beginning. And most of the story is going to be told from Debbie's viewpoint.
Okay.
All right. Are we ready?
Okay.
Now, I did mention the blockbuster movies that have been out. And the reason I mentioned that is, like I said, this book came out in 2015. In 2023, Blumhouse bought the rights for this movie. So no other details yet as far as who they might have in it or when it's coming out. I'm sure it'll be out in the next couple of years, but it was very sought after. A lot of people wanted the rights to the movie, and Blumhouse ended up getting it.
Oh, wow.
So we'll see what happens. So this actual haunting took place over a 6-year stretch from the late 80s to the early 90s by a force that the family would eventually call Mr. Entity.
Oh, well, that's original.
Well, there's a story behind it, and you'll hear it as we go.
Okay.
So you're probably wondering why the story that happened back in the 1980s didn't get any publicity until Jessica's book came out in 2015. Well, that's unusual in the case of a Warren's case, you know what I'm saying? Because they typically are all about the publicity.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But for some reason, they agreed to keep this secret as well. So I'm going to tell you why it was kept secret in Jessica's own words. She's the one that wrote the book. She said, "When you're brought up in a household suffocating in secrets, you learn to keep the silence. Or maybe the silence keeps you. My grandmother constantly warned my brother and me never to speak about anything we witnessed in our house. She always delivered this warning in the trembling, fragile voice of a plea."
Oh, man.
That's why it was kept
a secret.
The family was terrified. And you'll see why as we get going.
Okay.
All right. So with that being said, buckle up, Tracy, because this is a wild one. As a child, Jessica would have to carefully choose her words when she was talking to friends and family members and such. She was always afraid that some of the details of this haunting might actually slip out. How could she explain to anyone why she had to escort her father through the house after dark? Or why her grandmother flew into a series of panic-fueled prayers if she found a picture frame that was slanted towards the wall? At that time, Jessica didn't even know the answers to these questions. These topics were not up for family discussion. She couldn't explain what she was never told. So, she just knew that something was wrong with the house. All right, so Jessica and her family lived in California, more specifically, Rancho Cucamonga. Every time I hear Cucamonga, I think about Fred Sanford, because he would say something there once about Cucamonga.
Oh, really?
Jessica said that there were some odd patches on their blotched stucco on the inside of their walls, and the second floor was completely off limits. No one ever ventured upstairs. She said she can't tell you for certain when it all started because she didn't ask and no one told her.
And so how old again was she at this point?
I really don't know, because I couldn't find a whole lot about her and I didn't read her book to be able to see. I got some transcripts more from Debbie, her mother.
Okay.
But most people will say that the very first incident took place in 1981. This is right after the death of Domenica Cochiar. Now, that was the grandmother of her father, Bill Moffitt. But the true haunting happened from 1987 to 1992. Ed and Lorraine Warren, Dr. Evelyn Panglini, the most notable experts of the day, actually would eventually get involved and do investigations with this case. So, Tracy, we're going to discuss several of these people and events that happened, and this is going to be a very long episode, but trust me when I tell you that we're still only scratching the surface of what happened and everything that went on here.
I can't wait.
So, when we mention the first incident, I said that it might have happened in 1981. This is possibly after the passing of Bill's grandmother, and we discussed her. Domenica.
Yes.
So it's 1981. Well, the morning after the death, Bill Jr.'s parents, Lee and Bill Sr., they got a phone call at 3 a.m.
Hate that time.
It was the family's housekeeper, Juanita. Now, Juanita had just been hired to care for Domenica. And now she's passed away, and I guess mm-hmm. she's staying over there in that same house the day after the death. On this phone call, Juanita was screaming that she was being chased through the house next door, which is where Domenica lived. They lived right next door to their parents.
Ooh, that's scary.
So then Bill and Bill Jr. Now, Bill Jr. is an adult by this point, but he's still living mm-hmm. at home. They rush over to the house. Like I said, it's right next door. And as soon as they get there, Juanita bursts out the front door. But following her was a large orb of white light. The orb flew up in the sky and vanished. Juanita, though, she kept running next door to Lee and Bill Sr.'s house.
Well, did they see it?
Yeah, they saw it.
Oh.
She gets over to the front of the house. Lee's waiting there for her. And Lee's a woman, just keep in mind.
Okay.
But Lee's waiting there. And she ushers Juanita into the house. And Juanita wouldn't tell her what had happened. But she kept apologizing in broken English. And then she insisted that she only meant to help. Juanita then asked to make a phone call. And soon after, this car pulls up in the driveway. Juanita bolts out of the house. But right before getting in the car, she turns and gives Lee a warning. Don't go back to your mother's house. There's only evil there.
Well, that is, what do you say? What are you going to do?
So Bill wasn't having any of this nonsense. Bill Sr. You're going to find about Bill Sr. He's a miser. He's a Scrooge. All he cares about is money. So he demanded that the house be cleaned up and rented out, even though his mom just died there.
Yeah.
This is what's going to be done. During the cleanup process, the family made some shocking discoveries. Juanita apparently had some secrets of her own. All over the house, there were broken rosary beads that were placed in the corner of the house, candles, and bottled incense. There were also long scratches along the hallway wall. And get this, animal remains.
How in the heck?
I don't know any more specificity on that. Is that a word?
What is it?
Specificity?
No.
Specificity.
I don't know, but can I do one thing?
Yeah.
Need.
I knew it.
Juanita. Okay, go ahead. Sorry, I was dying to do that.
Now, Lee was a devout Catholic, and she was horrified at what she felt was the remains of a profane occult practice going on in that house. And maybe that's what Juanita meant when she said, I was only trying to help.
Oh, gotcha.
All right, so now we're going to fast forward to 1987, 6 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently nothing else really happened at that time. Debbie, who's going to be now the focal point of our story, we started off talking about her daughter, Jessica. But Debbie is married, or getting married at this point, to Bill Jr. Okay?
Got it.
So you got Bill Sr. and Lee, which is Bill's mother, father, and now Debbie's in-laws. They're living in the main house. They got two houses beside them that they also own. One of them is Bill Jr.'s house that his aunt and uncle had left them. And the other one was something I think that Bill Sr. had owned.
Oh.
But there were three houses right there together that they owned on Archibald Avenue.
They don't venture out much, do they?
No. So like I said, one was Domenica's old house. So keep that in mind. The first incident that Debbie says she remembers happening is when they rented out a room to a man named Danny. Now, this was over in John Jr.'s house. During one of the house inspections, Bill Jr. and Debbie discovered that someone had gotten into the den. Now, this room was secure. Mm-hmm. So they didn't rent the whole house out to this guy. They just rented him like a room.
Okay. So he had no business being in there.
Right. And this den was actually kept secure because this is where Bill Jr. kept all of his sports memorabilia. So it was important to him that some of the stuff was worth some money. In that room, there was a collection of baseball bobbleheads that had been arranged into a large triangle on the floor. So they assumed that Danny had to be the one to do this. He denied it, but he was the only sensible suspect.
Yeah.
Since he was living in the house. Well, days later, Lee found a, we'll say some lady's underwear draped over top of a statue of Jesus on her Catholic altar that she kept in the house.
They didn't drape it over his face, did they?
Kind of. I mean, it's little statue and underwear, so decent size.
Disrespectful much?
True. So she assumed that a family member was playing a very tasteless joke. Remember, she's a devout Catholic. She took this very seriously.
Of course.
They couldn't convince her otherwise. So no matter what they told her, they had somebody in that family had to have something to do with it. But every day, the altar would have some kind of new objects that were in Jesus' statue's arms. He was holding his arms out in the statue.
Okay.
So something was draped across his arms every day, some kind of new object.
Very bizarre.
Some of these items were Danny's personal belongings. So now we got Danny next door, not even in this house, but it was things like his wallet and his mail would end up in the arms of Jesus. And I've heard Jesus take the wheel, but never Jesus take the mail.
No. Well, I'm sure he would.
Danny decided that he was going to move out without any kind of notice. He's just gone. And then the objects stopped appearing in Lee's altar, so it made sense that, you know what, Danny must have been the guy.
Of course, if it stopped for
he's gone now, and it all stopped. With all the events seemingly having something to do with Danny, this problem seemed to be solved. So now we're back to renting the house again. Danny's gone, let's get somebody else in there. They had to go clean and do an inspection as they did before. So Danny apparently kept a pretty tidy house. Except for a few things that puzzled Bill and Debbie. So directly above every light switch in the living room, there were tiny symbols drawn in crayon. Now these symbols were completely alien to them. They had no clue what they were or what they meant. The only other areas that actually needed some cleaning was some dusting of a row of dog statues.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why there was a row of dog statues, but there were. These statues were actually on a high shelf in the living room. So Debbie turns and she yells for Bill Jr. to bring her a stool. When she turned back around, every single statue was now facing the wall.
Oh.
Something had turned them all around all at once. She tells Bill about it and Bill says, "Hey, you know what? I think you're just imagining things." Debbie said, "You know what, it's easier sometimes to just agree than to argue." But she knew what she saw. So the next day, they walk in. This is after locking up and everything the day before. They walk in and there's a lamp right in the middle of the living room floor. Doors were locked, windows were locked, and Bill Jr. couldn't deny this one.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, what's he going to blame that on?
Now keep note that nothing at this point had actually happened in front of them. Only behind their backs or when they were gone. So they asked whatever it was in the house to move something else. Nothing was happening, so they thought, well, maybe it won't do it in front of us. So they stepped into another room. They gave it about 2 minutes, and they walked back in. When they had walked back in, the dining room table was now right in the middle of the living room.
Well, he's an abiding ghost.
So Bill was terrified of the paranormal, and he went into a full-blown panic attack. Bill also suffered from cardiomyopathy. Is that right?
Yeah,
cardiomyopathy. Same thing I discovered. I might want to learn how to pronounce it since I suffered from it too.
Mm-hmm.
So this is obviously not good for him to be having full-blown panic attacks and stuff. They left, and they informed Lee and Bill of what had happened in the house. Lee was panicked as well. But not Bill. Bill Sr. kind of brushed it off and told him to get in there and finish cleaning this house. They need to get it rented. It's all about the money. It's all about the Benjamins, baby.
Dude, he needs to be spooked.
So the next people to move into the house were a couple by the name of Tom and Michelle. There was also another tenant, an old man named Monty, who was now living at Dominica's house.
Oh.
So this old man, Monty, he had actually made arrangements with Lee and Bill for his son, Brad, to move in with him. Not unusual to want your, you know, adult son to move in with you when, you know, you're probably getting up there in age.
Yeah, of course.
Brad was sort of a recluse, though. He never really spoke, never smiled. And the family just figured, you know what, he's just reserved. But they were wrong. So Lee actually went for a neighborhood walk one night. As she passed by that house, she noticed that Brad was planting a tree in the backyard. Problem is, he was planting it upside down.
Huh?
The roots were up in the air. Brad notices Lee. He stood up, shovel in hand, and he just stared at her. And Lee said he didn't just stand up. It almost looked like he rose up as if he was being pulled up by strings like a marionette.
Well, that's not creepy at all.
Lee said the way that this guy was staring at her, that she hurried up and ran to the house because she thought he was going to just start chasing her at some point in time. So she wanted to get to the house as quick as possible.
Of course, so he can get her inside the house and she can't get out.
Well, I'm thinking she's figuring she shuts the door, he can't get in.
Oh. It's
the other theory.
Okay.
I don't think she was inviting him in for lemonade. Then one day, Debbie notices Michelle kind of lingering out in the front yard. Her face was swollen. She was covered in fresh bruises. Debbie starts a conversation with her. Michelle whispered that, you know what, her and Tom used to get along fine, but he's become violent and irritable ever since they moved into that house.
She didn't say nothing about her face?
Well, I think that went without saying that he obviously beat her up. Thank you, Lily, for all the noise in the background.
Hey, what happened to your face?
So that's kind of what the assumption was. So Debbie said, you know what, let me take you to a shelter. But Michelle refused, saying that, you know, I'm a big girl. I can take care of myself. About a week comes and goes, and nobody's seen Michelle. Tom said that she had actually left, and she wasn't going to be returning. Go figure.
Oh, no.
Tom then actually left shortly after, just like Danny had done. He didn't tell anybody. He just left.
Mm-hmm.
So the house was spotless again. But one of the area rugs was missing. A rug that was kind of old and falling apart, so they didn't really care that it was missing. They just thought it was odd that he'd either thrown it out or took it with him.
Or took somebody with them in it.
A few days later, some strange man shows up at the house looking for Tom. Debbie informs him that, you know what, Tom left and he didn't leave any kind of a forwarding address. So he asked Debbie if she'd heard about what happened to Michelle. Her body had been found at a landfill wrapped in a rug.
Oh, Michelle.
Now, Bill Jr. was one of these guys who always kept up with the news. He either had a newspaper in his hand or he was watching the news on TV. So he had never heard about Michelle's body being found or any of that stuff. So he just assumed that the man was just trying to start some crap. Maybe he didn't like Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was just, you know.
Well, shit, that's a lot. Oh, excuse me. Shoot, that's a, sorry. I mean, that's something not good if you're not liking the man, you know what I'm saying, and just accusing him.
Right. But Debbie's first instinct was to call the police. I mean, if Michelle had been murdered, they might be the only ones with any information. But Lee, her mother-in-law, insisted that they mind their own business. Well, you see, Lee's father used to be a part of the Costa Nostras family in California, which were well-known mobsters. And she said if there's one thing that he taught her, it was never become involved with the police.
You know, go ahead.
So they didn't call the police.
Well, I know. That's just a shame, though.
With all that going on, they decided to sell all three properties. The house they lived in and the two beside, they decided, you know what? We're selling all three of these and we're moving to Rancho Cucamonga.
Well, good for them. I don't know what took them so long.
Well, right after they decided to do this, Bill Sr. found a framed picture turned backwards. This was in the hallway on the wall. This was the start of another round of unusual events in the house. So each day, household objects and knickknacks would either end up in some place unusual or they just would end up missing completely.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, if they're going to move out, I would definitely have left everything that was in there. You don't want to be dragging something along with you.
Well, you'd have to sell the house with all the stuff in it, because maybe people wouldn't have.
No, that's what I'm saying, though. So I would have done that.
So that went on until the day that they actually purchased their new home. So by December of 1987, they had moved into the new house. Wasn't completely settled yet. So Lee and Debbie went back to the old house to get the remainder of their possessions. And as I found, that doesn't always go well.
You should know, right?
So Lee and Debbie, they get to the old house. And they're getting the last little bit of things from Lee and Bill's bedroom. This is upstairs. They heard an explosive sound go off in the kitchen area. So they rush downstairs. There's splintered wood littered all over the kitchen. The cupboard had been almost completely ripped from the walls.
It exploded?
I don't know. Something like that. So they were standing there in awe. They're like, how in the world did this happen? And then they hear the shattering glass come from the bedroom upstairs that they were just in.
Mm-hmm.
So they rush back upstairs to find that the windows had been blown out from the inside, all the windows. And Tracy, we're just getting started.
Well, golly, I can't even imagine. This has been like the craziest thing ever.
So, because this is an extra long story, we're going to go ahead and take a quick sponsor break. By the start of 1988, the family was fully situated in their new home. 2 weeks passed without any strange happenings. It was finally over. Or so they thought. Bill Sr. discovered a framed picture reversed and now facing the wall. They were faced with the fact that possibly, whatever had tortured them at the old place had followed them into their new home. But maybe this just meant nothing. Lee said that she might have just accidentally turned the picture around when she was dusting.
Hmm.
So, you know, the family's at least trying to make themselves believe this.
Right.
Then the home's intercom system started beeping right in the middle of the night. For several nights straight.
Well, that's annoying.
Yeah, they would hear sounds like distant screams or cries for help. They would also hear their names whispered.
Oh, no.
In a low voice. They told themselves that the intercom system was probably faulty, so they just disconnected it. Because, you know, a faulty one will call your name out.
They're grasping, aren't they?
And you can imagine why. I mean, they don't want to believe that this stuff.
Yeah, you thought you were done with that crap.
Soon, the whole family was discovering objects around the house that had been turned backwards on a daily basis. Pictures, books, statues, dolls, all facing the wall. But here's the craziest thing to happen.
Well, maybe they were in timeout.
Lee went upstairs to clean the bedroom. And she discovered a message on the mirror written with a bar of soap. It said, "Talk to me."
No way.
It did.
Well, that's cool.
It was believed that somebody in the house had to have written this, but nobody confessed to doing it. So Debbie ended up going up there and wiping the mirror clean with a washcloth. The family, which was now kind of huddled together in the bedroom at the foot of Bill Sr.'s bed, they stayed there for 2 minutes. Upon entering the bathroom again, something new had been written. It said,
"Bitch, I said talk to me."
It said, "No escape."
Well, that is not a good sign.
The following days would provide more communication. Many of the messages were actually warnings, if you can believe that. Things like bad wire in the attic, or danger in the room, or death.
Do you think they said that just because it said talk to me and she ignored it?
I don't know.
Oh, sorry. I'm just thinking.
Other things written in the mirror were stay away and get this. Nanny, N-E-N-I. That was the childhood nickname of Lee. It was a name that only her older sister called her.
Whoa. I bet that freaked her the freak out.
Yes, because her sister had been dead for years. So Lee actually figured, you know what? This is my sister's spirit trying to warn us about something. But then Bill checked the attic for bad wires. He didn't find anything. Nothing else seemed to really be panning out. Debbie wasn't exactly sure why, but the spirit was trying to trick them. Because the next message written said, fools. Oh,
a jokester.
The next message actually took up the entire mirror. It said, I hate Lee.
Now she's going to have a complex, man.
Bill Sr. asked, who are you? Do you have a name? And then they stepped out of the room. When they returned, a single word had been written on the mirror. Prince.
Prince?
And it wasn't written in purple, I don't think.
So I want to know who he is. Or she is.
You're going to find out. So up to this point, Lee was hesitant to bring in any experts, we'll say, in the matter. But this was the turning point for her. So she turned to her faith and she invited a priest over to come bless the house. He made it to the front porch. And that was it.
Are you kidding?
He refused to come into the house. He splashed some holy water through the door on the inside. He mumbled a few words and then he rushed back to his car and sped off. Lee was devastated. She thought this was her answer.
Yeah.
You know, she's a very religious woman.
Of course.
She turned to her church and that's what she got out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure she was not expecting that.
Over and over, written in the mirror was, I hate Lee, and Lee died. This was only the beginning. The entity would soon start carving symbols into the walls and cut them into the rugs. Every surface was a potential canvas. The most prominent of these symbols was a large triangle with an S shape attached to the bottom, kind of like a tail.
I mean, well, what year was this? I was going to say, didn't they try to look it up? But they may.
No, well, they didn't have internet then. It was right. Like 87, 88.
Yeah, that's true.
They saw this symbol constantly throughout the house. The entity apparently had a hate for religion as well. It demonstrated this by constantly destroying Lee's Catholic items. The altar, remember we talked about she had?
Mm-hmm.
It was routinely dismantled and scattered all over the floor.
Oh, dude.
And the head and the left arm of every statue she had was then snapped off. Consistently, everyone, left arm, head.
Boy, this thing ain't playing.
Pictures of Jesus were found that had been thrown with such force that it had broken the glass completely out of them. So Lee was intimidated, and she wanted to move downstairs, but Bill refused to give up his bedroom. So one night, before Bill actually went to bed, he found that the mattress was actually cut into ribbons. So for safety reasons, Lee, Bill Jr., and Debbie shared the master bedroom downstairs.
Oh. God, this is, I mean, what the heck? You know, you can't keep moving.
No.
So.
Well, we mentioned earlier that when Jessica wrote the story, she said that the second floor was completely off limits. Nobody ever went up there.
Yeah.
This is when the second floor became abandoned. It's right after that incident with the bed. So the whole area became oppressive up there. You could feel the thickness in the air whenever you start to climb the staircase, mm-hmm. Debbie said. But this would not take care of the problem, just moving downstairs. The entity soon started to write messages on the downstairs mirror. If someone didn't clean the mirror, it would then start writing its messages, or they would carve its messages into the walls. So they would write, but it didn't have the ability to clean it off.
Oh.
The entity started an all-out attack on Lee. It destroyed her clothes. It would steal her personal items. And it was commenting on her daily life. For example, she would try to read the Bible for a way to be able to kind of calm herself down.
Uh-huh.
And then the entity would write God's fairy tale as she was reading the Bible.
No kidding.
I'm going to mispronounce this, I know. But Lee went on to start speaking a very rare language called Tabrirol Brisk. which is an Albanian dialect. She would talk to Bill Jr. this way, assuming that the entity would not be able to understand them, and she would at least get some sense of privacy. But then the next message, the entity actually wrote a message to her in that language.
Oh, sorry.
Bill Jr. And Debbie started looking for outside help through bookstores, occult shops, psychic conventions. And soon they had a constant stream of strangers, basically, coming over and in and out of the house. All these paranormal investigators and mediums were just flowing in and out. Then the first meaningful contact was a local group of psychics. They actually informed the family that the house was consumed by a paranormal entity. That term, entity, kind of stuck with them. And later on, that will obviously come into play.
Mm-hmm.
So the attacks on Lee became worse. Objects would fly through the air, usually from the back, and strike her in the head. Things like shoes and potatoes that would hurt, but wouldn't cause like lasting damage.
But this thing just never messes with anybody else but her.
At this moment, no. Then came the knives.
Oh, okay.
One day, Lee sat in a chair at the end of the dining room table. This is where she normally sat. And then she cried out and she leapt up from her seat. The blade of a knife had been stabbed through the bottom of the seat, and up through the top, and into her thigh.
Oh.
Everything in the house was a booby trap for Lee. She couldn't rest anywhere without fully inspecting the area. Let's fast forward a little bit. Now it's been a year in the new house, but the family was still being destroyed.
I don't know how in the world they stood living like that. It would be driving you insane, I would think.
Bill and Lee would creep around the house in the daytime trying to go unnoticed. They couldn't enter any room without the lights on. Every noise at night was almost like an alarm. They would hear something, they would both start screaming. And then Bill Jr. and Debbie obviously were in the same room.
Yeah.
So they would wake up. So it was just, they were, you know, it was, nobody was getting any sleep at all. And it would only get worse from there. All through 1988, the same stuff would happen, but the entity would add some new things into its little tricks to torment. Like the smell of excrement or rotting food would permeate the entire house. Strange noises and sounds of people walking around upstairs started to happen. The house became infested with rats.
Nope, I'm done. See you later. I don't care if there's a freaking ghost in there or not. We out.
For a month straight, crows made suicidal dives straight into their patio doors of their bedroom.
Dude, that has to be the devil.
During the rat incident, Bill said, you know what? I know how to fix this problem. It can be solved with poison. You put enough poison out, you'll kill the rats. The entity wrote, not only the rats will get to the poison. You'll figure. Debbie couldn't stand the thought of the rats in the house. She said these didn't seem like normal rats. She said these were the kind of rats that would stare you down. They were fearless. So she went to the mirror and she pleaded, please don't let the rats enter our house. Or at least don't let them get any farther than what they are right now. She said the next day, the scratching sounds that were in the walls ceased.
Well, that's good news.
So here's something crazy, as if we haven't covered enough already. They considered moving again, but the entity made it clear to them that it wouldn't make a difference. His family started finding little tokens from places where they'd visited, like a waitress's name tag from a restaurant that they'd just eaten at. Objects from a store that they hadn't purchased were showing up in the house. Or, get this, if they stayed at like a hotel to try to get away from it,
mm-hmm.
These same symbols and stuff would actually appear on the outside of the hotels.
Well, see, I was going to ask you that. Does it follow them wherever they go and do that stuff too?
Pretty much. So the only option they had was to survive. So Lee would spend most of her days at the kitchen table, just sitting there. I'm assuming there's no knives to the chairs. The family didn't sleep at all. They just, what they called, outlasted the night. Bill Jr., we discussed earlier, he had the bad heart condition. And his poor health just seemed to get worse under the stress. So between the torment, the conversations in the mirror, and all the constant home repair, the demands were taxing on the family.
Oh, I'm sure.
Debbie was confused about one thing. Lee and Bill Jr. were terrified of this thing. Why wasn't she? She felt that the entity couldn't hurt her for whatever reason, but why did she feel that way? She couldn't explain it. She just said, that's just the way I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So I just know that's the case, even though I can't explain why. And this is important because it was soon figured out that Lee would not actually be attacked if Debbie was by her side.
No kidding.
So late 1988, the family attended a psychic fair, and they learned about a shaman by the name of Red Wing. She was a Native American. Red Wing asked them to meet with her at the tribal elder in Los Angeles. Well, Red Wing was granted permission by her elder to actually help the family. Debbie said, though, that the elder stopped her as she was getting ready to leave, and even though she didn't understand the language that the elder was speaking, she said it seemed like it was something comforting. And then Red Wing said, explained to him what the elder had said. And the elder had said, you are not who you think you are. She wasn't sure what to make of that comment. And she's still not sure today what that really meant. But days later, Red Wing arrived at the Moffitt's house with another shaman by the name of Fire Panther. They asked Debbie to come upstairs with them. The air seemed suffocating up there. The two shamans decided to perform a ritual in the sitting room. Now, this was, of course, involved burning sage and things like that. But they tried to wave some smoke into the attic area because they said that's where it really seemed depressed.
Uh-huh.
And the smoke blew back out.
Oh.
There was no draft up there. The smoke was just being repelled for whatever reason. Red Wing said that she would need to face the entity in its own domain. So they went up to the attic. Fire Panther continued to burn sage and everything during this, and then he also began to chant. Well, Red Wing said that they were going to force the entity to reveal itself. Then they heard a sudden creak, and a roll of insulation slid down the attic's back wall. The roll of insulation started to reshape itself. Soon you could see a massive jaw, a deepened sharp cheekbone, and a horn where the ear should be.
Oh, how scary.
The shape faced the wall, just like all the pictures and stuff do.
Mm-hmm.
The shadow from one of the deep-set eyes was visible from where Debbie stood. So the insulation actually held its shape for several seconds, and then it collapsed in a heap on the floor. They walked back to the sitting room in silence. They were just trying to digest what they all had just witnessed. Red Wing said that the entity was far stronger than they realized, and they would not be able to rid the entity from the house.
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's insulation, for Pete's sake.
It's the Pink Panther. Next, at the end of 1988, a paranormal investigator by the name of Gary Kent said that he could help the family, but he needed to stay there. You're going to hear a lot about Gary Kent over the next several minutes. So Gary comes to the house, and he stood in the living room, and he said, show me what you can do. Well, at that time, a book came flying from the upstairs balcony area and hit Gary right on the side of the head.
Daggone.
From that moment on, the entity set its sights on Gary. It started shredding his clothes. It destroyed some of his belongings. It filled the mirror with insults about him and embarrassing personal information, which I don't know. I guess they didn't share what that was. So maybe it had a little, you know, wee-wee or something, and they wrote that on the mirror. Going in the mirror, Gary's got a little wee-wee.
Oh, Lord. He's just nasty, this ghost is.
The family would actually find some of Gary's partially burnt mail in their mailbox. Of course, he was staying there.
Well, I know.
So, on his bed in the guest room, they would find knives laid out in a pattern. And his room would be a complete mess, total disarray on a daily basis. Once, while Gary was at the table, they heard a snapping sound, and clumps of his hair began falling down from his head.
Oh, hell no.
He jumped up and he ran to the backyard, leaving a scattered trail of hair behind. So, this is about the time that Debbie learned about Ed and Lorraine Warren. She did this through their book, Demonology. She was sure that they could actually help her. So the Warrens, after she contacted them, let her know, you know what? We're supposed to be in L.A. for, you know, business. And when we come, it's in the near future, we'll go ahead and we'll stop by. During the preliminary investigation, Lorraine explored the house. So Lorraine informs the family that there was a demon in the house. It's one of the oldest and most powerful demons she had ever encountered. It was ancient evil, to put in her words. On the second day that they were there, they did a ceremony to invoke the demon to identify itself. So the following evening, the Warrens did what they called a rite of provocation. This took place in the living room. As Ed spoke prayers, a feeling of heaviness kind of filled the room. Bill Sr. suddenly slumped forward. And he rose to his feet, changing as he stood up.
Oh.
One of his arms curled towards his body like a shriveled limb. His spine curved into a low hunch. He hobbled towards Ed, dragging his leg. A low growl came from his chest that sounded more like an animal than it did a human.
So he finally decided to take somebody over, huh?
Yeah. So as Bill stood over top of Ed, Ed's hands flew up. In his hand, he had a small vial containing a shard of wood. He thrust it in Bill's face, and he shouted, "This relic is a piece of the Holy Cross, and it will protect me. You cannot harm me." Bill paused. He showed his teeth, and he said, "I'll bite it off your hand, I'll chew the wood up, and I'll spit it in your face."
Ooh, nasty.
Bill then set his sights on Lorraine. They stared at each other for a little bit. Bill then drug himself back to where he had been sitting, and he just kind of collapsed on the seat. The Warrens made arrangements with St. Mary's of the Angels Church there right there in L.A. to come and do an exorcism, but for whatever reason, that never happened. After the Warren's visit, Gary moved out.
Oh, did he? Yeah. Really?
Yeah, he's like, "I think I've seen enough of this."
Oh, my goodness.
The entity turned its sight right back on Lee again, though, with Gary being gone. So one day, Lee went to the pantry, and she opened it, and as soon as she did, the family starts hearing screaming and knocking. She had been locked in the pantry in the dark, and she had these red marks all over her neck. And then when they asked her about it, she said that the entity had attempted to strangle her.
Oh,
so
dude.
This was the breaking point for Debbie.
For Debbie? What about Lee?
Well, she ran to the mirror, and she shouted, "This is the way it's going to be. I treat you with respect, and you treat me with respect. And I'll accept nothing less." All this whole time that she's saying this, she's staring into the mirror, mm-hmm. Right? "You're not going to touch my children. You're not going to touch my husband. and you're not going to touch Lee. So she stepped out of the room. She gave the entity a few minutes to reply. When she stepped back in there, there was a message that said, "Will not touch your children, will not touch your husband. Lee belongs to me."
What? Can she not catch a daggone break?
So Debbie said, you know, "Hey, can you explain this to me?"
No, I'd be just like, "Lee, you're on your own, sister."
So this exchange went back and forth over an hour. The entity basically wrote in a nutshell that the story is from another era involving a French monastery in the 1600s. A cable of heretic monks actually used to worship this entity, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They did it in secret, obviously, because, you know, they're monks. They're not supposed to do that. So to honor their pact, they had said, they had entered into an agreement that they were going to perform a blood ritual. So they captured a nun for the purpose of doing this sacrifice. But one of the monks prevented this from happening. So the ritual never took place. Lee supposedly was that nun in a past life.
No.
Now the entity had returned for her in this life. So Debbie tells it that she could, you know, "I'm not going to let that happen." She wanted to show it respect, but she refused to call it Prince.
Mm-hmm.
So she thought, you remember it was called Entity. I will call it Mr. Entity to give it some form of respect. So that's where Mr. Entity came from. So Debbie began to converse with Mr. Entity on a daily basis. It seemed open to that, except it would never really answer one question. What are you? It was clear that it wasn't going to give up any information that could be used against it. One thing that Debbie noticed that was when she kept it in conversation, it was less active in the rest of the house. So, less attacks on Lee. So the key was to keep it going in conversation. I guess obviously not a multitasker.
Well, dude, but how long can you do that?
I guess these people didn't have jobs, it didn't sound like. So one morning, Debbie found these words actually in the bathroom mirror. "Lee will die in 10 days.
Aww.
Now, they'd seen hundreds of death threats against Lee up to this point, but this was the very first one that actually had like a specific
day.
Or should I say deadline.
Time. Yeah. Oh, deadline.
Lee was healthy, and the entity, you know, obviously couldn't kill her or he would have done it by now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not, though. Because on this day, 10 days later, Lee woke up with chest pains and shortness of breath. She was admitted to the hospital where she was diagnosed with pneumonia and congestive heart failure. After 3 weeks in the ICU, she was moved into a regular private room. Now, during this time, there was very little paranormal activity at the house. Just enough to let them know that it was still there. A turnaround picture or something like that.
Yeah.
Lee eventually recovered and was well enough to come home.
So
she loved that.
So while Lee was in the hospital, none of that crap was happening?
Very little. Some stuff, very little.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
So I said, I bet she loved knowing she could come home.
Yeah.
Lee said that while she was in the hospital, every time she would wake up, she would see a black stain on the ceiling. Now, that black stain would move closer and closer to her. And from that stain, a shape or a shadow, if you will, would appear and hover over top of her bed. But in between the bed and that shape, a mist of energy would form. And from that mist, a figure of a woman would appear. Lee said the woman turned and looked at her, and it was Dominica, her mom.
Aww.
So she was convinced that that her mom was coming to help. And whenever her mom would appear, or this entity would appear, the dark shadow would then just go to the floor and just disappear into the floor. So Lee's back home now, and she requires oxygen at least for the time being. She'd wake up in the middle of the night, gasping for air because the oxygen cord had been cut. During this time, Debbie tried not to leave Lee alone because she knew that was the secret to her, you know, not being attacked. But one time, though, she had to go talk to Bill Jr., and she told Bill Sr., stay with her. A few minutes later, Lee actually falls into the bedroom where she's talking to Bill Jr. She collapses on the floor. It turns out, after they ask her what happened, Bill Sr. had found an excuse to be able to go out to the garage, and he left her all alone.
Dude, men don't listen.
She said that after he had left in that second floor area where the book came flying at earlier.
Yeah.
She said she looked at that second floor balcony, had a shadow that was staring at her. And it had like a long, almost like a branch off of a tree for an arm. And it had reached all the way down to her. And then the shadow came down over top of her. And she said you could see a large open mouth with big teeth and large black eyes. So Debbie immediately runs to the mirror and says, never show yourself again. It messaged back, you get in my way. Stop protecting Lee.
Should have just said, bite me.
One night, Bill woke up because of something cold and sharp against his legs. It was a weapon like the family had never seen before. So Debbie went to the bathroom, and she wants to confront this entity. And she freezes when she saw two mirrors. They're actually filled with writing before she could even say anything. On one mirror, there was a demand. There must be a blood ritual. Take the spear and stab it into Lee's heart.
Okay, let me get right on that.
The left mirror had actually instructions on how to perform the ritual. Incantations, how to handle the blood, all the details that you would need. So Debbie said, no, there will be no ritual in this house. She held the spear, and she said that, you're not getting this back. It's like a timeout. You're not getting this spear back. But at that time, something slammed into the house. It sounded like a bomb had went off. Upstairs, every window had been blown out. Every window of the entire house. So she upstairs.
Pissed him off.
Even the curtain rods had nearly been ripped out of the wall. Tracy, we're not done yet, but we do need to take another sponsor break. So let's do that real quick. All right, let's talk about that spear, okay? So they take it to the Natural History Museum in L.A. A pair of experts ID this thing as a ritualistic tool from the Belgian Congo. And they said it was intended for magic ceremonies. They asked Debbie, actually, how she got the spear, because it looked like it was brand new, even though it had to be at least 200 years old. They told them that, you know what, you wouldn't believe us anyway, so we're just going to take our spear and go home. She should have donated it.
That's cool.
In the summer of 1989, their search for help led them to Dr. Evelyn Paglini. She had originally been based in Chicago, and she relocated to California. She gave Debbie some phrases and symbols that were to be transcribed on the mirrors. So here's these symbols and stuff. You go home and write that on the mirrors. But for everyone that she wrote out, the entity would cross it out like a big X and then replace it with one of his own symbols.
This guy's a jerk.
One message to Dr. Evelyn said, F you, you're lying to my family. Well, they had no idea why it was saying F you and definitely wasn't sure why they was thinking it was part of their family. They later did find out, though, that Dr. Evelyn was actually a founding member of the Satanic Church of Nephilim's Rites in Chicago.
Oh. She's got connections, huh?
So Dr. Evelyn and the entity wrote back and forth to each other for about a month. They seem to be at a standstill, stalemate, if you will. So the next place was for Dr. Evelyn to stay at the house, or at least come by the house. She wasn't going to stay like Kent was doing.
Yeah.
She was going to come by the house. So she instructed them to clean out Lee and Bill's senior's bedroom upstairs. So the family didn't know what her intentions were until she actually arrived at the house. One by one, she had them go into the bedroom that was lit by a single candle. So they were to stand in the center of the room.
With salt around them?
No.
Oh.
She would actually put her hands over them. She was trying to get a feel for their energy.
Yeah.
So Dr. Evelyn said, hey, I need to go home and ponder on this. And wait for the results to come in, like it was a CAT scan. She leaves. She calls them a few days later. Her news? Somebody in the family is keeping the entity there. Someone is giving it permission to stay.
You mean like somebody alive?
Yes.
Bill.
So, while it has that permission, it can't be expelled. A second ritual was performed to try to explore who was giving it permission. Hours after going to bed to the bedroom, Bill Sr. suffered a strange episode. It began with like a nagging cough, and then it ended up with him suffering like convulsions. So in the last meeting that Dr. Evelyn had with the group, she said that there was definitely a demon there. And it was one of the seven princes of hell.
Oh, well. Great, great googly moogly.
She said it definitely could not be removed because Bill Sr. was keeping it tethered to them.
I was right.
Well, you had a 1 in 4 chance. So.
Well, why was he doing
actually
that?
Two of them were named Bill. And you didn't say Bill Sr. Jr.
Why would he do that?
Well, I'm sure we're going to get to it. All right. Until that changes, the family was told to keep that bedroom empty and dedicate it to the demon. So now they just got to give the damn thing a room.
No kidding.
The demon could actually make their life pleasurable, and it was also the best way to save Lee. But why would Bill Sr. want the entity to be there? He may not seem like the, overly... sympathetic type. He didn't really seem to be concerned about all the stuff that Lee was going. Like, he didn't really go to the hospital much to visit her.
Right, I was going
to
say.
He was leaving her to go out to the garage. But replacing the daily damage that was done was very expensive. And that's the one thing he did care about was money. So, of course, Bill Sr. denied that this was the case. But Dr. Evelyn hadn't been the first person to actually suggest that there was a connection between Bill and the entity. The Warrens had said just as much. To try to fix the problem, they had suggested that Bill Sr. actually go meet with a psychiatrist. The entity, though, continued on, soaking Bill and Lee's mattress with water from the bottom up.
Wow.
A second mattress was pretty much on standby all the time because it took forever for that one to dry.
Now, I'd be okay if it was a waterbed, you know, kind of keep it pooped up and stuff.
It would erase Lee from family pictures. Like, she would just disappear in the pictures. They would then find pictures of her impaled on the wall with a knife right through her face. Lee's doctor's appointments would be called and canceled without her knowing it. She'd just show up and they'd be like, well, we canceled it. No, I didn't cancel it. Well, can't be seen today. Sorry. One shoe of each one of Lee's pairs would disappear. So she only had one shoe of each one.
That's annoying.
So let's go back to Gary Kent. Remember him?
I do.
He would keep coming back. Usually for a place to stay. He was just really down on his luck. Hey, I need a place to stay. Why he'd want to come back, I don't know. But this actually worked out because guess what happens when Gary's in the house? The entity focuses on him and not Lee. So they were okay with this. They probably let him stay for free just for that reason.
Yeah, really.
So, eventually, Debbie asked, why do you hate Gary Kent so much? And he was told that Gary actually lived in a past life in the 1600s in France, where he was the original abbot of the monastery where that original blood ritual was supposed to have taken place.
So maybe that's why he's drawn to coming back there, you think?
I don't know. It seems like if that was his case, that both of them lived in a past life and she was a nun and he was the abbot, it wouldn't make sense they keep finding each other. Because that's what they say, that past lives, you find people that you were connected in other past lives. So maybe so. So the entity wrote on the mirror, "He punished my servants, now he will be punished." It even said that it would take Gary as a sacrifice rather than Lee.
Hey.
So that was enough for Gary to say, you know, I'm going to leave. I don't think I can take that chance of being sacrificed and all. So in 1990, Bill Sr.'s personality changes. He becomes withdrawn, quiet, almost a recluse. He lost a bunch of weight and was absent at most of the dinners and other meals that the family had. But what was most troubling was that Bill's tendency to torment Lee. When Debbie and Bill Jr. would be out of the house, he would creep into the master bedroom where Lee was, and he would just sit on the edge of the bed mumbling to himself. But he would look towards Lee, and he'd just stare at her until Debbie and Bill Jr. would get home.
That's uncomfortable.
It is. So Debbie soon refused to even let Bill back into the master bedroom. Bill Sr. said that he was just going to return to the bedroom upstairs with the demon. So that's what he did. So Debbie asked the entity if this was his doing. And he responded with, "One mind to my body."
Ah.
The family's desperate at this point. They found another paranormal investigator. His name was Steve Blake. And they had found his card at an occult bookstore. There's some strangeness going on with Mr. Blake, though. He requested pictures and hair samples from the entire family. After they got him this, he came back and he says, just from the pictures and the hair samples, that Bill Sr. was possessed.
And don't
say. And he would take on the case.
Oh, he's excited.
He brought two friends with him to make sure that no one interfered with the ritual. So the entire family was instructed, including Bill Sr., to actually wait in the family room. Bill Sr. had no clue what Steve Blake was actually doing there. Uh-huh. He just knows he showed up. In the midst of the exorcism that was taking place in the bedroom, Bill Sr.'s body started to spasm and jerk.
Gary.
He went very still, and he started staring at the wall. Bill Jr. kind of ran over there ready to pounce on him in case he needed to restrain him. Bill Sr. starts to howl. So Bill Jr. goes over, pins him down to the floor with his wrists, basically by his wrists. Bill Sr. again starts to growl, but then he just stops right in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
He sits up. And you could only see the whites of his eyes as he first opened his eyes, like his eyes had rolled back. And then everything went fine. He woke up like, and it was just like he had woken up from a nap. He was a little drowsy, but he didn't know what the hell went on. That time where the growl just stopped, that's the same time that Steve Blake actually finished the ritual.
Oh, wow.
And so he's coming out of the bedroom. He explains that, guess what? Good news, bad news.
Of course there is.
I exorcised the entity that was possessing Bill Sr. But there's another more powerful presence in the home. And it's a presence that I don't think that I can get rid of.
Are you serious?
Yes. So, of course, the family was devastated by this news.
Well, I mean, I'm sure they were kind of happy that Bill wasn't possessed anymore.
Right. Well, down the road, I said this, it's strange with Mr. Blake. Down the road, they actually tried to recontact him. But he wouldn't, none of the calls that they had were going through. So they had his number, wasn't going through. And then they tried to go back to the bookstore. There was none of his cards out and there was no record of him anywhere.
What?
So it's like he disappeared from the face of the earth or like he never existed at all. All right. So get this. There's a twist to the story. So one day, Debbie notices Bill Sr. sneaking down the hallway to the bathroom. So she follows him. She sees him sneak into the bathroom, and he's at the mirror. So he's looking into the mirror. He's mumbling something. And she can see where there was some stuff that had been erased off of it. So after Bill leaves, she goes in and she's talking to the mirror. She says, mirror, mirror on the wall. I don't know if she said it or not.
Probably not.
She says, has Bill been talking to you? And he said, yes, the little prick wants to use me to kill Lee. He cannot command me.
Dude, what in the heck is happening here?
So Debbie knew that Bill Sr. could be, you know,
a jerk.
A jerk. We'll say a jerk. But she didn't think he really would want Lee dead. So Debbie tells Lee what she had found out through the mirror. And Lee said, you know what? I've kind of observed him acting kind of covertly as well. The day before, Bill hadn't showed up for breakfast. So Lee said, you know, I went upstairs, checked, see what was going on. When she got to the bedroom and looked in, Bill had got a box of all of her old bank statements. And he had them spread out all over the bed. And apparently she had gotten this out of the closet, but she didn't know why he had them out. Now, she said that the one thing to be aware of, though, is that her wealth had came from her parents. That's where she inherited everything.
Yeah.
And his name wasn't on the bank account.
Oh, smart lady.
Yeah. So if we've learned anything so far, we know that Bill's love of his life is probably not Lee, it's money. And Lee's death would actually leave all of that to Bill Sr. So Bill Sr. wanted to prove that, you know what, when he was confronted, you know, you're all crazy. I'm not going to even comment on the fact that, I would want an entity to kill my wife. So I'm going to agree to go to therapy just to kind of help people out. So you guys know that I want help in the situation. He goes to the psychiatrist and he starts having these little meetings and he mentions the entity to the psychiatrist. So what do you think happened?
I don't know.
They locked him up for observation.
Oh, yeah. They I guess they would, yeah.
Yeah. Well, eventually it was due to be let out.
But wait.
What?
Isn't that doctor-patient confidentiality?
No, they can suggest you. They don't have to tell you what's going on, but they can suggest you need to go away for a while.
Oh.
Doctor can still put you in the hospital.
Okay.
Especially in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
So, Bill has now been in the hospital for a little bit, and they're going to let him out. He's went under his observation period. They think he's okay. They're going to let him out. So, Bill invites Lee up to the room when they go to let him out. Hey, come up to the room. Well, when Lee gets up to the room, she immediately, after being confronted, leaves and she storms out and gets in the van where I guess the other two are already at.
Mm-hmm.
She goes and gets in the van. Turns out Bill Sr. had convinced the doctor that he was lying about the entity, but Lee believed 100% in it. And he thinks she may need help. So when she got up there, the doctor confronted her and was like, hey, I just want to help you. And she was pissed. Well, then Bill comes out and gets in the van like nothing had happened. So, all right. They're driving home. Lee is stewing over this.
Why does she even let him back in the van?
Well, when they get to the driveway, she says, Bill, you know what? You need to pack your stuff and leave. Take your truck, go. Bill said, I'll be back, though. Well, 2 months after he had been gone, the family realizes they were better off without him there and his mood swings and his unpredictable behavior. But for the next 2 years, the family still looked for ways to get rid of this entity because the entity was still there, even without Bill. Lee and Bill Jr. spent most of their time in their bedroom downstairs. Mr. Entity still damaged the house and verbally attacked Lee. The incident started to dwindle a little bit, though. He seemed to be losing a little bit of his power. He still loved, the conversations, and he liked to show off his vast knowledge of things. So, they would spend time conversating with him, but not, you know, with the mirror. And it would keep him occupied and also kind of let him lose some of his energy.
I mean, I'd be like, dude, you're making me exhausted. I don't, you know, you're not even worth it anymore.
Well, then he starts bringing in new objects into the house, stuff like rocks and clothes, that stuff like that, and pendulums and pictures of strangers. And when Debbie asked him, why are you doing this? He said, because I want you to have them. Well, let's go to 1992. Gary Kent.
Did he arrive again?
Gary Kent calls him and he says, you know what? I'm really down on my luck. I need to move back in.
Dude, you must be down on your luck. Why don't you go to a shelter or something?
So Mr. Entity started using the last of his energy to destroy Gary's clothes and everything else he's doing. One day, Gary ran out of the bedroom and he was holding a shotgun. And he said that this was under his pillow and it was loaded.
Oh.
So one day, this is going to surprise people, but one day, Gary tells Debbie, you know what? I'm moving to England. And I want to ask the entity to come with me.
What?
He felt that this entity had the power to turn his life around, even though it's been nothing but hell since he met.
And she's like, hell to the yeah, go ahead.
So Debbie tells Gary, you know, you might want to rethink that. And Gary says, you know what? I've got absolutely nothing right now. What do I have to lose?
Poor Gary.
So Gary went to the bathroom and he openly out loud asked the entity to follow him, but he didn't get an answer. So he goes and he talks to Debbie and he says, you know what? He likes you. Why don't you ask him? So Debbie said, hey, do you want to go with Gary over to England? And it responded with, I will not work with an inferior being.
Ooh, boy, kick him while he's down, why don't you?
He said, I will defeat him if I must. So when she asked, why do you hate Gary now? I understand why you hated him back then.
Sure, let things go.
He said, no integrity, no homage, no character, no substance, no word. I will stop him in his pursuit. And she thought, why would a demon care about those characteristics or qualities?
No doubt.
But then Debbie remembered Dr. Evelyn Pagolini. Remember her?
Yes, I do.
She had said the entity couldn't be cast out as long as he was given permission to stay. Bill was gone. So did she have the power to actually get rid of this demon now?
Mm-hmm.
So October 1992, 6 years after the entity had entered the life, Debbie said, you know what? Dad's gone and he isn't coming back. There's no one to keep you here or for you to feed off of their hatred. I think it's time for you to leave. Its reply, please let me stay here. So over the next month, Gary got his stuff together to get ready to move to England. The house was fairly quiet. On Gary's last night, Mr. Entity wrote, I want to stay here. And Debbie says, why don't you just go with Gary? And he said, he's not stable.
And he is?
He's a shallow vessel. Well, she said, you can't stay here. At least he wants you.
Mm-hmm.
He responded, Gary is me. I am him. So Debbie called Gary in to read the message. Gary was excited and left for England. Debbie, right afterwards, goes and looks in the mirror, and there's a parting message. It said, goodbye, my family. And that's the end of our story, and I have no idea what happened with Gary after that or any of that, but that is a story of the Moffat family haunting.
Wow. What an incredible, crazy story.
Was it the best?
Yes. I mean, he could have been gone so long ago if Gary just said that earlier.
Probably so. Or maybe Gary is who was keeping him there when he came back and stayed, because they could have gave him the boot before Gary came.
Right, right. Well, but they wouldn't have known that, though, right?
Well, they knew it 2 years earlier. They knew it that Bill was the one holding it there, and Bill had been gone for 2 years.
Man, that is a messed up story. I mean, dude, all I can give them is praise for hanging there like they did all those years. I don't know how I could have ever managed that.
Yeah, that is officially our longest story. Yeah. We're an hour and 20 minutes in.
Wow.
And about 10 minutes of that was the beginning stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's about an hour and 10 minutes
worth of story. That was a really good story, baby. Thank you.
It took all damn day to write it.
I know it did.
So, all right, guys, that wraps this up. We'll be back with some cool announcements real quick. All right, Tracy, a couple of things. The cruise. Starting to get down to the nitty gritty on the cruise because you only got to July to get it paid. So mm-hmm. We're in March already. So you still got plenty of time where it only costs you a couple $100 a month. But that's your easiest way to do it. Go to our page, hillbillyhorrorstories.com, and there's information to get a hold of Robin and the gang out at Vacation Experts. All right. Two live events we told you about. April 27th, Casadega. Only 30 tickets available. We've already sold, I don't know, a bunch of them, about half of them. So don't waste your time on it. It's Us History Goes Bump. It's a very small, intimate setting. That's why there's only 30 tickets available. It's a great restaurant, limited menu. I picked some good stuff out for you. I picked the menu, so if you don't like it, but I got some salads and some vegetarian stuff and some pasta and some
good
burgers.
Well, a little bit of something for everybody.
Yeah, it's not a huge selection, but there is a variety.
Good.
So that's going to be fun. Tickets are only $25. You can get those on our website as well. And then the 17th, we're at St. Augustine.
We are. I'm very excited.
Again, when History Goes Bump, there's only 60 tickets available for that. That's going to be our birthday show. And we've already sold, 6, 7, 8 tickets of those mm-hmm. already. So don't hold back. Both of these shows are going to sell out.
I hope so.
We did the last St. Augustine show, sold out like 2 months in advance.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, you can come look at the beautiful history of the town.
Just being in St. Augustine is fantastic. You can stay right there on site where we're doing the show at. Mm-hmm. I need to post. They gave me room rates now. I need to post that.
Oh, you did get that?
Yeah. Okay. I'll get that posted one day this week and you'll be able to look and see. But you can call Beecher's Lodge in St. Augustine and they can just tell them you're with Hillbilly Horror Stories. Otherwise, you won't get the special room rate.
Right.
So that's an important thing to do. What else was I going to tell you? All right. So I'm going to renege a little bit on something that I'd said before, but you got to realize we're doing it for the right reasons. So we said we were going to cut everything down to just these 3 episodes that we do a week, but we're going to bump that back up to 4, and I'm just going to be as transparent as I can with you guys. We have literally lost half of our revenue by cutting back. Mm-hmm. And, I'm going to add one more episode in a week. It's going to be something we haven't done before. It's all listener stories. It's going to be Hillbilly Horror Stories Presents Classical Listener Story Episodes. So you're going to hear from our listeners tell their stories. And the first one where it's going to come out, it'll be on Tuesdays when they come out. They're going to last, this first one lasts about 40 or 50 minutes. The second one's about an hour. So they're not short episodes. And you're going to be able to hear stuff you've never heard before, because these were all Patreon stuff. And the first one was from, I think, June of 2018.
Okay.
So we're going back, almost 6 years ago? Mm-hmm. But that's what it'd be. It'd be once a week. So we'll have 4 episodes out. It will be a longer episode. It won't be like, the other ones that were 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever. They'll all be 40 minutes to an hour. And, like I said, I hate doing it because I like the idea of only having the 3, but I also like eating. So paying the rent, paying the mortgage and stuff. That's paying car payments. I like doing all that stuff too.
Yeah, we don't like it, but. Yeah. So, we have to.
I already went out and got a regular job, but it's hard to make money in today's world, as most of you know. So even with that, it's going to take that little bit extra. So there you go. Start looking for that. And sorry, but you got 4 episodes instead of 3 now. Tracy, what do you got going on over there?
All right. For our reviews, we had Kay Cummins, C to the Ale, Skay Morris, 007, and Mojo Lobster.
I think that's S.K. Morris.
I know. What'd I say?
Skay.
Oh, I probably just carried out my K. Thank you, guys. I mean, you guys really have done us a huge favor by leaving those reviews. We cannot thank you all enough. You know, we're trying to get back up and get our podcast back up to where it used to be. So when you all do that, that really helps us. So it's really working. Keep it coming if you can. Even if you just send something to put a question mark. Or I don't know. Whatever. No, not a question mark, because then everybody would be like, what's that mean?
So, yeah. And I had posted something because I wanted to see if it made a difference about unsubscribing and resubscribing. It does make a difference.
Okay.
The leaving reviews makes a difference. And, you know, I tell people, you know, we get paid by the number of listens that we get. But it's not just the number of listens. It's got to play for a little bit. So, you know. Just anything, if you listen to us on long car rides, I know Jake Shirley had posted earlier that he'd had a 9-hour trip to New York where he had listened to us. And, you know, that's a big plus.
Oh, it is, right?
But a bunch of episodes in 9 hours.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
All right, guys, we love you so much. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and we'll see you next week.
Have a blessed week. Love y'all.